Good to see all of you this morning. Good to have the opportunity to study with you as we conclude many of our thoughts regarding the history and geography of the Bible as we wind down concerning the preaching tours of the Apostle Paul. We've been studying from Acts 21 through 28 is the text I've asked you to read. Acts 21 through 28, you'll notice on the board I've also asked you to read Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians, and Philemon. And why those particular books? What do we know those four books as?
Prison epistles.
The prison epistles. And why do we call them the prison epistles? Betty?
That's where he was,
yes. That was the first Roman imprisonment where he wrote those. And then I've asked you to read 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus. And what's the significance of those in the preaching life of the Apostle Paul? Well, not only did he write them, but the time when he wrote them.
Next time he was in prison.
All right, the second Roman imprisonment. He wrote 1 Timothy and Titus, and then, I didn't say that right, 1 Timothy and Titus in the interim between the two imprisonments, and then 2 Timothy during the time of the second Roman imprisonment, where we know that he anticipated being executed. So this is the purpose of our study and the things that we want to talk about. And we're studying from Acts chapter 21 through 28. And we know that the apostle, or rather that the writer Luke, leaves us hanging in suspense regarding what happened to Paul as we come to the end of the book of Acts. In our study this morning, I want to pick up our thoughts from the text from Acts chapter 22. Acts chapter 22. I want to preface our thoughts, however, with some things that we discussed in our class on Wednesday night. We noted that as Paul came into the city of Jerusalem, he had been forewarned a number of times that things were not going to be well for him when he came into the city. However, we do also note that Paul did not anticipate that he would be executed in the city because he had been assured that he would preach in Rome. Now, as we think of Paul preaching in Rome, I dare say that Paul did not think about the events transpiring in Jerusalem and his subsequent imprisonment being the means by which he would preach in Rome. Sometimes things don't always turn out like perhaps we planned them to turn out. But Paul, when he came into the city of Jerusalem, he discovered that there was a problem. The elders, of course, a good thing here on verse 17, the elders and the church received him. But the elders tell him that there are some who are Christians, in fact, quite a few who are Christians. In fact, the word myriads is used in the footnote of the American Standard Translation. In the text, it says many thousands. And we want to underscore many thousands among the Jews of them that have believed. Now, the significance of that is we're talking about Jews who have become Christians. And they have heard some things about you, Paul. They've heard that you preach against Moses, that you teach the Jews not to circumcise their children, and you teach the Jews not to walk after their customs. Well, we know none of that was so. And the elders, in order to hopefully ease the problem among the Jews that were believers, instruct or ask Paul to take these four men who had a vow upon them and go into the temple and be at charges for them, that is, pay the charges for the things necessary to accomplish their vows. And so Paul does that. And we talked about that Wednesday night as we discussed traditions and customs that exist among people and how that we can engage in the practice of those customs as long as they do not compromise our conscience or compromise the things that God wants us to do. That is, the truth that He has revealed. And we talked a little bit about eating meat, sacrificed idols, and various things such as that in our study on Wednesday night. But this was to be the solution to the problem. And you see how that would alleviate the problem. People seeing Paul doing the very things that folks over here are accusing him that he's teaching against, certainly ought to defuse and disarm those accusations. But when you've got folks that are determined to create a problem and to believe something that's not right, all it takes is just a few folks to come and fan the flame and you've got a big problem. Somebody told me one time, Mick, it only takes one disgruntled soul in a congregation to destroy it. And I believe that's right. Now, case in point, you look at, what's his name? I just drew blank. Third John. Diotrephes. Diotrephes. We know that Diotrephes, being among the brethren there in Third John, John says that he won't receive us. And here's John, a man who had fellowship with God and fellowship with those who are righteous. And John said, Diotrephes won't receive us. And them that would, he cast them out of the church. Now, do you think Diotrephes, one fellow here, was creating a problem in the church there where he was a member? Well, certainly. So it only takes one. But here we've got several folks who are Jews from Asia. You see that in verse 27. Verse 27, Jews from Asia, when they saw him in the temple, this is chapter 21, stirred up the multitudes and laid hands on him. And here's what they say. Everywhere he's been, he's caused problems. And they address this to the men of Israel. So they're stirring the mix, lathering up the people into some kind of an angry mob that is going to create problems for the Apostle Paul. Now, let me pass beyond that. When this chief captain sees what's going on and sees Paul basically at the center of all of the controversy, he arrests Paul. Well, is it because Paul has done something wrong? No. Why did he arrest Paul? Why didn't he arrest all these thousands of Jews that are creating the problem? Well, that's true, but here we have Paul. He's at the center of the controversy. He arrested him to save his life. That's exactly right. They're going to rip Paul to shreds if he don't get him out of this crowd of folks. Now, Claudius Lysias is the man's name. We don't know that until we get to the 23rd chapter. All we know at this point is that he's referred to as a chief captain, but we know who he is when we see this transpiring in the 23rd chapter. We know that Claudius Lysias becomes the man who delivers Paul at least three times because of this mess stirred up by these Jews. And we have that on the board. In Acts 21, here in our text, verses 31 through 33, and then again in Acts chapter 22, where Paul is before, again, the multitude after his arrest and is making his defense. And then in Acts chapter 24, in verse 7, beginning, it tells us, verse 7, from whom thou wilt be... That's not the passage I'm looking for. 24, verse 7. That's not the passage I'm looking for. The passage I'm looking for is 23, verse 7. All right, that's incorrect on the board. 23, verse 7. It says, and when he had so said, there arose a dissension between the Pharisees and Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. Now, Paul took advantage of that. What was the identifying factors of the Sadducees and the Pharisees, particularly in this text? Makes for an exciting study. The resurrection. The Pharisees believed in the resurrection. The Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection. And of course, the center of Paul's teaching was the resurrection of Jesus. Now, if there is no resurrection, as Paul develops that point in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, then Jesus was not raised from the dead. But seeing these opposing views in the Jewish court, some made up of Sadducees and some Pharisees. Of course, Paul interjects that he's a Pharisee. And therefore, he believes in the resurrection. Well, now we see this court, the highest civil authority among the Jews, they're fighting now among each other. Can you imagine that in a judicial proceeding? The folks who are running the court, they're fighting. And so Claudius Lysias, once again, gets Paul out of that environment and eventually takes him to Caesarea, where He then appeals his case, as we'll see, to Rome. Now, certainly, Paul is not going to have any kind of a fair hearing in a Jewish court. But I ask you to turn your Bibles to Acts chapter 22, where I want to pick up some of these things. In Acts chapter 22, after Claudius Lysias has arrested Paul, and he takes him up the stairs, it appears, to what is sometimes referred to as the barracks, a place where the soldiers were, Paul pauses on the stairs and desires to address this multitude of Jews. And look, if you will, please, beginning in verse 3 of chapter 22. Paul says, "I am a Jew, born in Tarsus of Cilicia, but brought up in this city at the feet of Gamaliel, instructed according to the strict manner of the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, even as ye all are this day." Now, to preface Paul's sermon, if we want to call it that, this is a, I don't want to say it's not inspired. It is inspired, and that gives these words, of course, great weight. But an introduction to such a sermon as Paul is going to present in this passage, this is absolutely profound. Paul, though he was born in Tarsus, where was he raised from a little boy? In the city of Jerusalem. What has Paul been doing all of his so-called adult life in the city of Jerusalem since Acts 2? Persecuting Christians. He, no doubt, was in Jerusalem when Jesus came. Keep in mind, those who were in Jerusalem were among those who were devout Jews. Remember that from Acts 2? Would that not include this man who had been reared at the feet of Gamaliel? You think Paul didn't know this man named Jesus that's come into town and claimed to be the Messiah? You think he didn't know that he had been crucified? You think he was unaware that these men who were identified as apostles, the disciples of the Lord, they've been preaching that he was raised from the dead? You think he didn't know that? Well, sure he heard Stephen's sermon. And what was Stephen teaching? The same thing that the apostles had been teaching. That this man named Jesus came to town and you didn't believe him to be the Christ, and so you killed him, but God raised him from the dead. And they stoned Stephen to death and Paul held their garments while they did it. Yes, he knew what was going on. Who better qualified now to understand the background of these Jews who are stirring up the controversy and the opposition, the persecution, if you please, against Paul, than Paul? He knows precisely where they're coming from. He's been taught exactly the same thing that they've been taught, and probably better than they have. And so this introduction here in verse 3 is just astounding. He says, being zealous for God, even as ye all are this day. Just how zealous was he? I said, well, he held the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death. Come on into the first part of the 8th chapter, and what did we see him doing? The 8th chapter. All right, he's dragging Christians before the court. It's his desire to make havoc of the church and destroy it, if he can, completely out of existence. In verse 1, Saul was consenting to his death, chapter 8, and there arose on that day a great persecution. Well, now, who do you think was likely at the basis of a good bit of that? Saul was. And now, Bruce, as you come into the 9th chapter, verse 1, what's he doing? All right. All right, what does he want to do? Destroy the church. Tells us he made havoc of it. Now, understanding that, when you come to Acts chapter 22, and Paul's now making his defense, he makes mention of that. This is what I did. And in verse 4, He said, "And I persecuted this way unto the death, binding and delivering unto prisons both men and women. And also the high priest doth bear me witness, and all the estate of the elders. From also I received letters unto the brethren, and journeyed to Damascus to bring them also that were there to Jerusalem to be punished." Now, when Paul is making reference to what he used to do, how far back is he reaching in his life? Keep in mind, Acts is a book of history. He's reaching back. It's what I was way back yonder when. How long ago? About so. About 20 years. Yeah. This is what I was. Now, what does that tell us about some of these fellows that he's talking to?
They were there.
Yeah. You see, some of these fellows that are here today know that I approached them to get letters to go to Damascus and kill these folks. Now, they know what I did. Now, in verse 6, it says, "It came to pass that as I made my journey and drew nigh unto Damascus about noon, suddenly there shone from heaven a great light round about me, and as I fell unto the ground and heard a voice saying, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me?" Now, this is common ground to all of you. You know that when the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, this was sometime after the resurrection of the Lord. And when he said, "Who art thou?" And the Lord said, "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest." Now, how do you argue with that kind of evidence? Would you? "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest." Did Paul know this was miraculous? Well, absolutely. And why did the Lord appear to him on the road to Damascus sometime after Jesus had been raised from the dead? Why did he do that?
Paul said he was chosen out of due season.
To do what?
To bring the Gentiles.
Alright, going to preach to Gentiles. What are we going to preach to Gentiles? We're going to preach to Gentiles remission of sins. In whose name? In the name of Jesus of Nazareth. Now, question, how could he know that this is Jesus of Nazareth and what he would preach about that was true?
Well, I had a comment about the other part.
All right, go for it.
Well, and you said the reason that he was given this particular way of being introduced in 22:15 says for him to be a witness.
All right.
And he can't be a witness of something he hasn't seen. He didn't walk.
That's right. That's right. And what is it he's going to be a witness of? The resurrection. That's right. So he had to see the resurrected Christ. Yes, Randy?
You just asked a question. Oh, about how did he know this was Jesus of Nazareth? Because he said, "I am Jesus the Nazarene."
That's right. Because he said. Now, he wouldn't know that if this was not a miraculous manifestation of the resurrected Jesus.
The other thing I want to point out is he says, "I am Jesus the Nazarene, whom you are persecuting."
Yes.
But he's dead. All right, he was dead. Now he's alive. Now he's in heaven. How is Paul persecuting Jesus? Well, he's persecuting Jesus by persecuting his body.
That's right. That's right. And an interesting observation, conclusion there that we, I think, must draw is that how we are treating the church, that's how we're treating the Lord. I don't think sometimes we get that thing put together just right. We're treating the church this way, that's how we're treating the Lord. If I'm spasmodic in my worship and encouragement of brethren, then I'm spasmodic in my service to the Lord. That's how I'm treating the Lord.
Now, this may be a little different, but it's kind of contrary to what a lot of people believe. But Paul was, you know, knocked down. He was blinded by the bright light. And as he was blinded by the bright light, you know, that was something that would be a definite miracle to me. But, you know, a lot of people say that they're blinded and they see Jesus, but this is not what that is.
No, not at all. Not at all. In the 23rd chapter, note that Paul taps this again in his defense before the Jewish court. There in verse 11, it says, "And the night following, the Lord stood by him and said, Be of good cheer, for as thou hast testified concerning me at Jerusalem, so must thou bear witness also at Rome." Now, he saw the Lord on the road to Damascus. And here again, in Jerusalem, the Lord stands by him and tells him the things that he's going to do in Rome, indicating that your death is not going to be at the present. It's not going to be here in Jerusalem. It's going to be sometime later. Now, in the 22nd chapter, I want to continue that thought. When the Lord said, "I am Jesus of Nazareth, whom thou persecutest," what do you think would be the very next question out of Paul's mouth? Now, what must I do? Well, what has he done? He's been persecuting the church, persecuting the Lord, and now he sees that's obviously not the course to pursue, so what must I do? And what did the Lord tell him? Go to Damascus, and there it will be told thee what thou must do. Now, of course, we're familiar again with this text. Ananias the preacher comes to Paul, Saul of Tarsus, as we know him at this point, and we note that he heals him of his blindness, and Saul, having asked the question, "What must I do?" In verse 16, Ananias tells him, "And now why tarriest thou? Arise and be baptized, and wash away thy sins, calling on the name of the Lord." While we're there, I want to pick up verse 15 too. It says, "For thou shalt be a witness for him unto all men of what thou hast seen and heard." Again, to your point, Lynn, you can't be a witness of something you haven't seen, something you haven't heard. And when the Lord appeared to Saul on the road to Damascus, according to his defense in chapter 26, that was what he was intended to do, to be a witness of the resurrected Christ. And you'll see that beginning in verse 16 of Acts chapter 26. And being a witness of these things, he would then instruct the Gentiles how that they could enjoy the remission of their sins. Now, having said all that, let's look once again at Paul's years of imprisonment. This chief captain, he's determined to deliver Paul alive, Claudius Lysias. We know in chapter 23 that Paul is making his defense before the Jewish court. And I want to make this observation in verse 1. Paul, looking steadfastly on the council or the court, said, "Brethren, I have lived before God in all good conscience unto this day." Now again, picture this. Claudius Lysias has arrested him. Paul has made his defense on the steps going up into the barracks, as some believe that is. And then in chapter 23, on the morrow, we find that Claudius Lysias delivers him unto the Jewish court. Now, if you were Claudius Lysias, Roman captain, and what is a captain? What rank does he have? What does a centurion have? 100 men. Now, what does a captain have? 1,000. He's captain over 1,000 men. And what is his primary objective? What's his job in Jerusalem? Keep the peace. Well, is there peace in Jerusalem? There's a mob. There hasn't been peace since the day Jesus got there, you see. And so we've got all kinds of problems going on here. Claudius Lysias has a tremendous job. Thousands of these Jews are in an uproar about this man, Paul. Thousands of them. They want him dead. And Claudius Lysias, exercising his responsibility to keep peace among the Jews. Who would you think to be the, or what would you think would be the next step, the next responsible step? What would you do with Paul?
Put him in protective custody.
Put him in protective custody, alright. We're still going to have to make a decision. What are we going to do with him? Who would you take him to?
Your boss.
Alright, well, before we get to that, in his relationship with the Jews, who would you think would be the next one to listen to Paul? Their court, yes. You'd take Paul to the Jewish court. This is where matters are settled in the city of Jerusalem and among Jews. So you would think now as a Roman soldier in exercising your responsibility to keep peace among the Jews, here's a man that's got problems with the Jews, let's take him to the court of the Jews. Wouldn't that seem reasonable? as the next prudent judicial step. All right, so he takes him before the court of the Jews. And Paul, standing before them, tells them that I've lived before God in all good conscience unto this day. What does Paul tell them about his past life, even from a little boy being brought up at the feet of Gamaliel? I'm one of you, yes, but even more than that. What did I do?
He was an honest man.
I'm honest. You see, here I persecuted the church. I tried to make folks who are Christians to blaspheme against the Lord. And I did that thinking that what I was doing was right. Now, I want you to think with me just a moment. Here is a court of men who are Jews. I don't think it would be far-reaching to think that many in this court knew who Paul was. They knew his history. They knew what he had done. And now here he is telling them that I have abandoned that way of life. I no longer persecute the church. I no longer am interested in putting Christians to death. But now I believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be. He is the Son of God. But while I was doing those things, I did it in good conscience. But notice, if you will, in the latter part of verse 1, until this day I have lived before God with a good conscience. What's Paul done? He feels good about it. He's abandoned the practices of these Jews. And he's become a Christian. And he's done so with a good conscience. Now what's he saying? He's honest. His desire to be right continues to drive him. That's what drove him when he was persecuting Christians. He thought he was right. And now he's left that way of life. Now he has become no longer Paul the persecutor, but Paul the persecuted. And he still believes that he's right. What do you think that's going to do to the ears of those who are now hearing him in this court? Pardon me? Irritate them. Yeah. You were one of us. You thought what you were doing was right. You left us. And now you think what you're doing is right. What are you saying about us? Well, if he's saying anything, he's saying they're wrong. Now, that's not going to sit well on the ears of those who compose this court. These who are in charge of Paul's life. And then as you drop down into the text, when Paul perceived, verse 6, that some of them were Sadducees and some of them were Pharisees, he identifies himself as a Pharisee. And he said, touching the hope of the resurrection of the dead, touching the hope and resurrection of the dead, I am called in question. Well, then he throws this issue out in this court. So now they're mad at him, but then they become mad at each other. And what does Claudius Lysias have to do about it? He's in charge of keeping peace. He's in charge of 1,000 soldiers to keep peace in the city of Jerusalem. We're going to have to take Paul back into custody, that's right. But wait a minute, this Jewish court, they're responsible for Paul. He's a Jew. This disturbance involves Jews. Why can't they settle it? Because, you see, they've left their appointed job as being a part of the judicial process. They're arguing and fighting now among themselves about whether or not there's a resurrection. And Paul's at the heart of it. And if you'll notice in the text, in verse 15, it says, now therefore do ye with the council signify to the chief captain that he bring him down unto you as though he would judge of his case more exactly. That's not the verse I'm looking for. Verse 10. It says, when there arose a great dissension, the chief captain, fearing lest Paul should be torn in pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him by force from among them and bring him into the castle. Take him by force. Now, can you picture that? That's kind of hard to imagine, isn't it? Here you have a court that's responsible for settling judicial matters among the Jews. And now the court is so messed up, they want to kill each other, and Claudius Lysias sends his soldiers down there to take this prisoner away by force. What do you suppose these soldiers go armed with? Swords and spears, and they go into a court proceeding, and they take the prisoner. Now, that's what I want you to see just here, Randy.
I just think it's interesting that the only reason this is all happening, well, other than the prophets of God, but the reason this is happening is because of the Jews from Asia that stirred up the crowd when he came out of the temple and saying that he was in there with the Ephesians and all that stuff. Well, it occurred to me it's odd that these Asian Jews were following him around, stirring up trouble everywhere he went. We find that in Matthew chapter 17 as well. Jews from Thessalonica. But here, the church is in Jerusalem, and we don't have a record of them dragging any of those guys in front of court. Paul and James, and, or Peter, I mean, Peter and James, and John, and those who were teachers and preachers in the church in Jerusalem. We don't have a record of them being dragged before the court and made to defend themselves.
Well, actually, the early chapters of Acts, we do.
Well, the early chapters.
Trace that thing back about 20 years, and that's exactly what this court did to the apostles.
Right, but at this point in time, this is a few years later, and why are they all worked up about Paul and don't seem to be concerned about the church that's still growing in their own city?
Well, that's an interesting question, and we're just not told the answer to it. I don't know the answer to that. It's not here.
Except that these Jews from Asia that
They were good at it. You know, I find that interesting as an observation. Folks that want to cause trouble, they're generally pretty good at it. Yeah. But when it comes to trying to establish truth and stabilize and teach, and that's, we work at that. But we can be very careless and still cause trouble. We don't have to be very good as far as developing abilities. We can cause trouble. Now, you're right. These were good at it. And they seem to follow Paul about everywhere he goes. And the thing that I find interesting there is, who's minding the store? You know, what do these folks do for a living that they have the time, the resources to follow Paul around from here to here to here? And we're talking some pretty good distances. And stir up multitudes to try to get Paul put to death. Now that's what's happening here in Jerusalem in this court. And Claudius Lysias rescues him again. Now the passage I wanted to note a few moments ago. In verse 12 beginning it says, "And when it was day, the Jews banded together and bound themselves under a curse, saying that they would neither eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. And they were more than 40 that made this conspiracy." You suppose they got hungry? Well, the text tells us they came to the chief priests and the elders and said, "We have bound ourselves under a curse to taste nothing until we have killed Paul." Again, the chief priests and the elders. Who are we talking about? All right, we're talking about some who no doubt were a part of the Sanhedrin court. And they come to the court that is charged with resolving matters, disputes, and so forth among the Jews. And they tell the court, "We've entered into a vow that we're not going to eat or drink until we've killed this man." Now, we would like to think that if you told somebody that who was a judge or somebody who was in the position of settling judiciary matters, that you would be the one to be put in jail, right? But no. You see, this court, they want Paul dead too. And it says in verse 15, "Now therefore do ye with the council signify the chief captain that he bring him down unto you as though ye would judge of his case more exactly. And we, before he comes near, are ready to slay him." All right, let's set a trap. You who make up the court, you send word to Claudius Lysias to bring him down. We want to try him again. We've got ourselves all settled down and we're going to do this right. And while he's on his way, we'll kill him. But Paul learns about this through his sister's son. And he calls in one of the centurions to get the chief captain, and the chief captain, it tells us in verse 18, took him and brought him, so he took him and brought him to the chief captain and said, Paul the prisoner called me unto him and asked me to bring this young man unto thee who hath somewhat to say to thee. And the chief captain took him by the hand and going aside asked him privately, what is it that thou hast to tell me? And he said, now who are we talking about here? All right, Paul's nephew. And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask thee to bring down Paul tomorrow into the council, as though thou wouldest inquire somewhat more exactly concerning him. Do not thou therefore yield unto them, for there lie in wait for him of them more than 40 men who have bound themselves under a curse neither to eat nor to drink till they have slain him. And now are they ready, looking for the promise from thee. Now, this chief captain appears to be a very honorable man. And he prepares a group of soldiers that Paul places himself under. Perhaps the chief captain, of course, has charge over Paul. But he's determined that he's going to deliver Paul safely to Caesarea. And in verse 23, it tells us that he called unto him two of the centurions and said, make ready 200 soldiers to go as far as Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night. Now, Miss Jenny, mathematician in the family, this is not a real hard one. We've got 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen. How many we have? You cheated. No. 470 men that this chief captain is called together to deliver Paul safely to Caesarea. Now, you'll notice that these are soldiers. These are not folks that are just going to argue in Paul's defense. They're prepared to give their lives to deliver Paul. They'll fight. Trained soldiers. And the text tells us there in verse 24, well, before I get to that, third hour of the night. Richard, what time is it?
Be about
9 o'clock in the night. That's right. And so, why does he select that time? It's dark. We're going to get Paul out of town before the sun comes up. Yeah. And we're going to take him over there to Caesarea, and we're going to provide him safe course unto Felix the governor. Now, here's where we learn this man's name. Verse 26, Claudius Lysias, in the writing of this letter, unto the most excellent governor Felix. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be slain of them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. And desiring to know the cause whereof they accused him, I brought him down unto their council, whom I found to be accused about questions of their law, but have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. And when he was shown to me that there was would be a plot against the man, I sent him to thee forthwith, charging the accusers also to speak against him before thee. What is it that Claudius Lysias has done? We use terminology a little different, but descriptive of the same thing. What is it Claudius Lysias did?
He changed the venue.
Exactly right. Very good. He's not only changed the location, but he's changed the nature of the court. Who's Felix?
Governor.
Here is a Roman official. The Jewish court. Who were they?
Jews.
All right. Settled disputes locally. Now he's moved him up the ladder. He's got him before Felix. That was his intent. To take him before a Roman court. Because he knows that he can't get justice in a Jewish court. You see. Yes.
I don't think Claudius Lysias has the health of Paul is concerned at all. I think that he is concerned that there is a riot fomenting in Jerusalem and he wants to get this guy out. I mean, he has twisted the letter already, saying that he learned that he was a Roman and that's why he rescued him, and that's not the case at all.
That's true.
As far as I'm concerned, Claudius Lysias, as far as he's concerned, Paul is just another Roman citizen that needs to be treated like a Roman citizen, but that's about it.
Well, that could very well be it. But you're right. He has twisted or perverted the things here in this letter. That was not why he wanted to get Paul out of Dodge. He's a Roman citizen, and he does have the right. Perhaps it's speculation to say he has some concern about things being done right. But nonetheless, he's pursuing the correct avenue to preserve Paul's life and to suppress this uprising in the city of Jerusalem. So he escorts him by night to the city of Caesarea. Now, we know that some of these soldiers travel with him over as far as Antipatris. Others go on to Caesarea. But he's well armed enough to safely deliver Paul to the proper authorities where his case can be heard. Now, in chapter 24, by the way, this is about 70 miles from here to here. Now, you think you can make 70 miles in a night? Pardon me? Not walking. Well, that's not the objective, is it? It's to safely get Paul out of town. Now, beginning in chapter 24, verse 1. After 5 days, the high priest, Ananias, came down with certain elders and with an orator, one Tertullus, and they informed the governor against Paul. And when he was called, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, "Seeing that by thee we enjoy much peace, and that by thy providence evils are corrected for this nation, we accept it in all ways, and are in all places, most excellent Festus," or Felix rather, "with all thankfulness. But that I be not further tedious unto thee, I entreat thee to hear us of thy clemency a few words. For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of insurrections among the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarene, who moreover essayed to profane the temple, on whom also we laid hold, from whom thou wilt be able, by examining him thyself, to take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. And the Jews also joined in the charge, affirming that these things were so." Now, is what Tertullus said the truth or not? Well, what are the charges? All right, was that so? Was that so? Our trumped up charges. But you see, all these Jews that are here, they can testify to the accuracy of what I'm telling you. No. They would just join in these false accusations as they had in the city of Jerusalem. Now, the governor, Felix, beckons to Paul, and Paul begins to speak. Is Paul pleased to have the opportunity to speak before Felix? Yes, yes. When we think about Felix, what kind of character is he? Nobody can tell me anything about Felix? That was Agrippa. But when we think about Felix, we need to go back and do some research on Felix. Aren't he greedy? Yeah.
He's married to a Jew.
He's married to a Jew, yeah. So we might not expect necessarily a fair hearing.
Well, he knew a little bit about the Jewish.
Yeah, he knew a little bit. Sometimes Philip knows a little bit. It's just knows enough to be dangerous. What else do we know about Felix? Well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to leave that for you for a research question. You figure out what you know about Felix as far as his character is concerned.
I wrote some very tiny notes.
Ah.
You tell me if they're right.
Okay.
Known for low ethics, former slave.
Okay.
That,
I think that's correct.
Drusilla was his third wife.
That's correct. At least.
Scrupulous. I'm not sure what this means. Supposed or supposed. Reduced crime on highways, but also a tyrant. And then I wrote assassins rose up. Was there a lot of turmoil during his...
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, you've got the outline. Just develop it and you'll have that down. And you can find out something about Drusilla while you're in the process. But the conclusion I want you to come to is that Drusilla and Felix were not very reputable people. They weren't your next door neighbor type that you would
they
want to live
typical
with.
Typical politicians?
Maybe a little bit more than typical, but yes. Yes, they were not good people. They were not good people. But yet we find that Felix treated Paul kindly. He allowed his friends to come and minister to him. And in the latter portion of this text, we know that Felix listened at least to what Paul said. And this is very familiar ground to you. In verse 25, it says, "And he reasoned of righteousness and self-control and the judgment to come. Felix was terrified and answered, 'Go thy way for this time, and when I have a convenient season, I will call thee unto me.'" Johnny, James, some of you who preach, write those 3 points down and plug that into the life of Felix, and then tell me why Felix was terrified when Paul preached that. He had reason to be terrified based on who he was and the life he had lived and those kind of things. And to know that he was going to have to give an accounting of these things. And Paul's hammering that. It tells us that he was terrified. Now, another interesting observation we might make in verse 25 is, though he was terrified when Paul preached to him about the awful things that he did and the accountability that he would have, he sent Paul away and said, "When I have a convenient time, I'll call you." In other words, don't call me, I'll call you. The rest of this passage tells us somewhat about the why. He hoped with all that money would be given to him of Paul, whereof also he sent him the oftener, or sent for him the oftener, and communed with him. But when 2 years were fulfilled, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus, and desiring to gain favor with the Jews, Felix left Paul in bonds. We might make the observation, Carolyn, here that Felix, typical politician. Whatever pleases the people, that's the decision that I'm going to make. But another interesting observation, I believe, just here, and Jenny, mathematician in the family, I want you to be counting time. And what we want to see is how much time Paul has invested in being a prisoner from the time that he's arrested in Jerusalem till about the time he's released from Rome. I think that's fascinating. Okay? You got that. So you'll be looking for that as we go through. All right? So Felix anticipates bribe. Doesn't happen. He leaves Paul in jail. Festus then becomes the new governor of Judea. And in chapter 25, it says, "Festus, therefore, having come into the province after 3 days, went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. And the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews informed him against Paul, and they besought him." Now we've got a new political leader. What are we going to do about Paul? Well, Felix, did he do anything? No. But we got a new man in the office now, and we still hate Paul and we want him dead. And here comes Festus to Jerusalem, which we will refer to as the center, as it were, of Judaism, the center of Paul's problems here. And so Festus goes to Jerusalem. And what do the leaders of the Jews want to do with Festus?
They want Festus to bring Paul to them.
Yeah, you bring Paul down here, that ornery scoundrel, we want to kill him. Here's all the things that he did, and Felix didn't do anything about it, and we're dependent upon you. You do something about it. Carolyn?
So 2 years went by where Felix did nothing, so then when Festus comes in, they figure they'll stir the pot.
Yeah, see, this just don't go away, does it? Typical politician. Won't go away. So we're going to do what we can do to stir the pot and get it going again. Now, that tells me that we're out of time just here, but we're going to start in Acts chapter 25. Hopefully in our study Wednesday night, and pursue just a little bit further and talk about those things that eventually result in Paul's deliverance to Rome.